Good morning. It is a real honor and a privilege to be here today. And I'll tell you, we live in an amazing part of the earth. We live in an area that is rich in wildlife and plant diversity. And we live in an area that provides us with our basic needs. We all have water, we all have food, and we all have clean air most of the time. And we have seasons. And I want to, I'm going to share some stories with you and then talk about a project that I have been working on with Blue Mountain Television and Daniel Biggs. And so I want to just tell you that I had the great privilege of working up here in the Blue Mountains for 10 years with the U.S. Forest Service. I was a field biologist for them. And then I went for another 10 years and worked for the state of Washington as a, I did riparian restoration. And for those of you who do not know what riparian is, this is a riparian zone right here to the north of us. And that is the flood zone of any stream or river. And I will just tell you right now, never build a home in the riparian zone, because that's nature's way of telling you not a good idea, because that is the floodplain of that stream or river. Riparian areas are super, super important because they reduce the temperature of the water, they provide wildlife habitat, and they also do something else, and that is they filter a ton of polluted air and give us oxygen. So the amazing thing in this area, there are so many amazing things. We have in excess of 600 native plant species that live here in the Blue Mountains. We have over 340 species of birds that utilize this area. We have about 45 species of mammals that utilize this area. And we have literally hundreds and hundreds of species of insects that are all over this area. And lots and lots of people, and the first thing I want to talk about are insects. Lots of people hate bugs. Every bug they see, they kill, and there's even companies based on their entire GDP for that company. They go out and spray broad spectrum pesticides to kill all the insects in people's lawns, because people just hate bugs. The bottom line is, we're shooting ourselves in the foot, because there are so many very, very valuable insects that most of us couldn't identify if our life depended on it. The bottom line is, everything is sewn together and interdependent in this world. And we are dependent on certain insects. And I, Roger mentioned briefly bees. If we did not have bees on this earth, we wouldn't have any stone fruits. We wouldn't have a lot of our flowers. For those of you who like artichokes, you wouldn't have artichokes. So insects, and many, many insects, are very, very important. At the same time, we have deleterious insects, like mosquitoes, that spread disease. And it's not by their choice. Diseases come into these insects. So I want to tell you a story. When I was growing up, I lived in Africa with my family. And we lived in the country of Malawi. And Malawi is in Central Africa. And it is completely landlocked from either the Indian Ocean or the Atlantic Ocean. And it has 70 different languages in Malawi.
Oh, wow.
So that's 70 different tribes in Malawi. And so the British came along, arbitrarily drew these lines for the country of Malawi, and then granted those people their independence. Well, no one had been trained to run a government. They had been trained in picking cotton, tea, and coffee. And that's what the British needed in their empire. And so that's what they created, was this knowledge about those three plants and what to do to defend those crops. So the most common defense of crops in Malawi was great big cans of DDT. And I have personally reached into those cans and sprinkled it all over our garden out of total ignorance. Because there were all kinds of very, very valuable insects that would come into our garden and eat pest species. And we were just broad spectrum killing everything that would enter our garden. So one day, we had a very wise Australian gentleman come, and he was staying in our home, and my dad had this big can of DDT sitting in the back veranda, and he saw that, his eyes got big, and he goes, "What are you doing?" He says, "Do you know that you're killing all the praying mantis, you're killing all of the insect-eating beetles, you're killing everything that's protecting your garden by using that DDT?" At the time, this was in the early, mid-60s. Nobody knew the effects on birds or on humans. And what DDT does to birds is it thins their eggshells out so that even the pressure of the female sitting on her eggs crushes them. And that's what happened to the American bald eagle and to peregrine falcons. They were affected by DDT. So, lots and lots of third world nations still use DDT because they have no environmental laws. So we just got through talking about under the law. In North America, it was outlawed. In Mexico, it is not. So we have an interesting thing going on. We have thousands and millions of birds that nest in North America and winter in Central and South America, where DDT use is everywhere. And they feed on insects that have been infected with DDT, and they drink water that's been infected with DDT, and then they come back up here. Well, we're all DDT free, but those birds are affected, and they're called neotropic migrants. So anyway, I want to share with you a story from Malawi. So when I was a young kid, we arrived there when I was 7 years old, and the first things I saw flying around were tropical butterflies. And I thought, ooh, I've got to catch some of those. Well, it became more of an obsession than an interest. And I got, my mom sewed up a great big butterfly net, and my dad put together a big aluminum pole with a big loop in it. This thing was a meter across, so I couldn't miss. And I had five or six African friends, and we would go into the bush after school, and I would go butterfly collecting. Well, I would get out there, and there were so many butterfly species. I mean, it was phenomenal. The next thing my dad had to go into the operation of was building display cases. So he built them so they had sliding glass top, and they had a cork bottom, and I was pinning, and I had. By the time we left Africa, I had 2,300 butterflies in display cases. I took up three trunks coming back to the United States with my butterfly collection. Well, what we didn't stop to think about was maintenance of that large collection and identification of so many of those butterflies. So when we got back to the United States, I had just dozens and dozens and dozens of these great big 2 by 2.5 size display cases. And so the first thing I did was try to identify all the species I had. I couldn't do it because some of them had never been described. And I would try and figure out the family they were in. Well, the families weren't even there. So finally I found a book, The Butterflies of Malawi, and it was this thick, about a half inch. There were hundreds and hundreds of butterflies in Malawi, and they were displaying 60 or 70 species. And it was like, this is no good. So my dad took me to the museum, the Natural History Museum of Malawi in Blantyre, Malawi, and I got to wander around and look at their butterfly collection. I thought mine was large. Theirs was decades and decades and decades of butterflies being collected. So I developed a friendship with this gentleman. He was an English gentleman that did all the butterflies, and he was a lepidopterist. That's what his title was. And he told me about a guy that lived up in the Nano Mountains above where we lived, who was the government rock geologist. He was a semi-precious, precious stone geologist. And he and his family lived up by a falls east of our mission compound. And his name was Mr. Mariani. And Mr. Mariani had a son named Luis. And Luis collected butterflies. And that's how the gentleman at the museum in Blantyre knew about this family. So Luis and I became good friends, and when his dad and he would drive through our compound on the way to their home, I would get these boxes come rolling out of the back of his Peugeot pickup, and inside, packed in paper, were butterfly specimens. And I would chuck boxes back to him as he went by, and I would trade butterflies with him, just like people trade stamps. And he lived up on a river called the Kulamadzi River, which meant cold water river. Kulamadzi in Chichewa was cold. And so we traded butterflies. Well, Luis's father, Mr. Mariani, had mounds of semi-precious stones all around his home that he'd collected from all over Malawi. And we would go up and just wander through his massive collection. It was amazing. So Mr. Mariani told me, he said, you know that this area here has had virtually no science done on it. Nobody knows what's living here. No one knows the insects or the fish in the river or anything else. And so it was like, whoa, this is like a massive Easter egg hunt. And this is going to be fun. So I went down to the Nkulamadzi River, and it was about the size of Mill Creek that flows through Walla Walla. And the first thing I saw was this big fish, this big. And I was like, wow, I've got to come fishing here. Well, then I found out from the old-time missionaries that a missionary in the 1920s had brought German brown trout and put them in that river. And who knows what native fish once were there, but the brown trout had certainly eliminated them. And so the lesson to me was never introduce something that's not native to the area. And so we ate German brown trout in the middle of Africa in Malawi. These big, huge brown trout. But the amazing thing was the diversity. And then 2 years later, we moved to Zambia. And we were on a mission compound with a big hospital and a leprosarium. And the leprosarium had about 400 active lepers that were there, and they were all taking what was called Dapsone, which is a drug that arrested leprosy, did not cure it, but stopped its spread. Unfortunately for my brother and I, where do you think most of the butterflies were? They were down in the leper colony. And that's where I would go down with my big net to go catch. And I would have lepers come out, and they would want to go and watch me catch butterflies. Children are especially susceptible to leprosy. And so my mom, when she found that where I was going, she says, nah, you're not going there anymore. So she contacted the museum in Malawi and said, what could he use for a trap to catch butterflies? And the guy wrote back and he said, what you do is you mash up a banana, an overripe banana, put some mango juice on it and set it out, and butterflies will come into it. And if you really want to make it good, put some dog poop in it. And the butterflies can't get enough of it. And so that's what we did. And I would catch scores and scores of butterflies. So I brought the butterflies back to America, and half of them are at WSU, and half of them are at the University of Puget Sound. And so that was an amazing thing. But what was amazing to me was how many different butterfly species were in that as two tropical countries. And the diversity was astounding. So I used to ask, why were there so many? And that's because there were so many niches where each species could live and not affect another species or compete with it. Very seldom were there butterfly species competing for the same niche. So we had a butterfly. It was absolutely gorgeous, and I wanted to bring one, but the case is too big. And so I had this butterfly. It's called a mother of pearl. It's this big. Wingspan is 6.5 inches across. It is absolutely mother of pearl. It's absolutely gorgeous. And it's greenish with this pearl, mother of pearl reflection in the light. And all butterflies are covered with scales. And these scales reflect the light. Some scales are pigmented and some of them are refractive. So you're never quite sure whether you have a pigmented butterfly or refracted butterfly. So, like many birds, did you know there are birds that have no pigment on them? And they are refracted light. And that's like the western and mountain bluebirds. That's all refracted blue waves. And that's what you see. So, I collected this mother of pearl. It was absolutely gorgeous. And I was so excited about that. I pinned it just right. I never touched it. I put it in the display case. It was like, this is unbelievable. So that was my favorite butterfly. Then one day, the pastor from the church said, Mike, you must come to the church. There is a bug there, and I don't want to mess with it. And so I went down, and here's this huge moth. And it was a sphinx moth. And this particular moth was called a death's head hawk. And it has a perfect human skull on its thorax. Perfect. And I thought, well, that's really strange. But I thought, what a cool looking insect. It had a very dark upper wing and a beautiful yellow underwing, and it was big. And I thought, ooh, I've got to catch this thing. So it was sitting on a pew. And the pastor says, I can't tell anyone which pew it sat on because nobody will sit in that pew. So he says, catch it quick. So I got my net and I caught it. And when I went to pick it up, do you know what it did? It started doing this. It was a butterfly that made a noise. And it was unheard of. I've never heard of a Lepidoptera making any type of noise. I've caught beetles that make noise, and I've caught other insects that make a sound, but this particular sphinx moth went, and it was like, with that skull on it and making this strange noise, it's like, I see why people get a little perturbed. So anyway, that particular moth is sitting on display at WSU in the Connor Museum. You can go see it anytime. But anyway, so there were all kinds of amazing things that I found. So I shared a bedroom with my brother, and he had his bed on one side, mine on another, and in between us I had a table, and as my mother called it, the menagerie. And that's where I had a great big fish tank. I had all kinds of glass jars. And this was stuff that I would find in the bush and drag home and put in these containers and watch it. Well, my mom would knock on the door and she'd say, Mike, is anything loose? She didn't want to come in the room because I had lizards and snakes and mice and all kinds of stuff. And my brother would pull all the blankets up off the floor so nothing could crawl up while he was in bed. And so anyway, it was incredibly enjoyable. My parents promoted my interest in the natural world. my mom got flashcards, and on the front was a drawing or a painting of the animal or bird or insect or plant, and on the back it would tell you all about it. And she would set it in the crack in the breakfast table, and we would have 3 a.m. and she would ask us, what is this, what is this, what is this? Then the next day she would read to us about each of those 3 organisms, and then every week we did 6 organisms and we would learn all about them. So we could point out all kinds of things there. So one day my mom says, Mike and Joe, you boys are going to the African school because it'll be good for you. And we thought, wow, that's where all of our friends went to school, so this was going to be a kick. So we went down to the African school, and I just want to share with you what it was like. It was much different than going to school on a radio, because that's what we did. We were under the British system, and we had a shortwave radio to Salisbury, Rhodesia, and our teacher was on the other end of the radio, and Joe and I sat there and listened to her on the radio and did our work in our books. So my mom sent us down there. We met the headmaster, very, very nice gentleman, and he placed us in a room. And we had long benches with slate boards. How many of you went to school with slate boards? And that's what we had, because no one could afford all the paper. So we had styluses with slate boards, and there were 5 of us per bench. So we sat there, and the teacher would come in, and immediately all the students stood up, and they said, good morning, teacher. How are you? And we would stand up and stand there. We didn't know what to say. And he would say, thank you, Christ. I am fine. And they would all sit down, and we would proceed with class. And so all of our friends were, they would always look over to make sure we were still there. And the class would proceed. So we did mathematics, and we did social work, and we social studies, and we did what they called science. And that's what got us in trouble. One day, the African teacher held up an animal, and he said, this is a kangaroo. It was not a kangaroo, and I immediately let him know that that was not a kangaroo, and I was immediately sent to the headmaster's office, and he said, we cannot have lots of face in front of the whole school, and therefore you must go home, and I was expelled. So that was my expulsion from the African school, and Joe survived 3 or 4 more days, and he did something that caused loss of face, and he was booted. So it was an incredibly interesting experience, but I'll tell you, what we found was that there were no hard feelings. It was like, you don't know. You don't know how we study and what must be done and how we do our studies, and so you live in a different world than we do. And we said, well, we want to learn. So we were given a second chance to come back and sit in that classroom and do as the teacher told. And so it didn't matter if it wasn't a kangaroo, we just sat there. And so we had an amazing experience going to school with all these African children, and it was fun, and we learned a lot, and the most important thing was we learned the language. And so my brother and I ended up learning Chichewa, and that was a lot of fun because that allowed us to visit with all kinds of people, and that was fun. So I want to tell you one more story from Africa, and that was 80 miles north of us was a massive game reserve called Luangwa Game Reserve. Luangwa was 100 miles across, 300 miles long. And it had 21,000 elephants when we lived there. And so my parents Both my mom and dad were outgoing people, and so we pulled into the game park. We had driven into it, and all the way around the game park, there was no fence around the game park, so wildlife was everywhere. So about 15 miles before you got to the game reserve, you could look out and see impala and puku and eland way outside the game reserve. And once you got into the game reserve, there was just wildlife everywhere. And it was all built around the Ruangwa River, which is this river the size of the Snake River. Great, big, huge river. So my parents pulled into this game park and went to a big camp where all the tourists camp. And it's called Nsefu Camp. I'll never forget it. And there were two old-time British guys sitting there. And my dad pulls up and he goes, "Good morning, gentlemen. We'd like to see some elephants. We haven't seen any elephants." And they looked at my dad like, "Are you stir crazy? There's only 21,000 of them in this game park. How have you missed all these elephants?" And so my parents said, "Well, we'll go look." So we drove outside of Nsefu, did not even get to the main road, and here was a group of elephants right beside the road. Our very first wild elephants. Unless you have seen elephants in the wild, you can't even imagine what it's like, because there is no fence or moat between you and that elephant. And they're just standing there. And it was a family group of about six animals, and they had a little calf with them. And the next thing we knew, my dad had stopped right there, and my mom was trying to photograph the calf, little tiny miniature elephant. And what happened next was the female put her head down and her ears started flapping and she started trumpeting and running straight at the car. My mom was so intent on getting a picture, she said all of a sudden the viewfinder filled with gray. And I was like, "Well, what's going on here?" And she put the camera down, saw the elephant running at the car, and dropped the camera. Fortunately, it fell inside the Land Rover and not outside. And my dad took off, just racing down the road. And he was yelling. He was scared. And he started yelling, "So you want to see more elephants? You want to see more elephants?" And it's like, well, not that close. So anyway, so we got to see all kinds of wildlife. And I grew to really love going to this huge national park. So I have to tell you, we made some very good friends on the edge of the national park, and it was three Catholic priests at a Catholic mission. One was Canadian, one was Belgian, and one was French. And they loved to see us coming, and they said, "How are our fellow Christians?" That's what they wanted to know. And they would put up a big supper for us, and we would sit and visit, and then we found out we were the only other English speakers that would stop and visit with them. So we got to stay there anytime we went to the game park. So they were amazing individuals, and one time we showed up there and they were still shook. And we said, "Well, what's wrong?" He said, "Well, the Canadian priest said, I went out and I shot antelope for supper. And we had it cooked up, and we had it sitting in the middle of the table, and it was, the building had a big round dining room with French doors on either side to the outside, and then bedrooms that went away from it." And the next thing he said we knew, we were all sitting there cutting our pieces of meat off that antelope, and a hyena came in, jumped up between two of the priests, reached over, grabbed the meat, the antelope off the table, and took off with it. And he said, they were both standing there, sitting there with this hyena between them, reaching for that, the main dish. And so anyway, but we had all kinds of amazing experiences. So you've got to be asking yourself, why is he telling us all this? So when we moved back to the United States, we came to College Place in August, and there were huge dust storms blowing out of the western part of the county. It was hot, and that was the summer. It was 30 straight days of 90 or above. I will never forget it. We lived on Davis Street in College Place in a basement. And these big dust storms, and it was hot, and I thought my parents had cracked up. Why on earth would you come to this horrible place? There's no wildlife. There's nothing to do. And the next thing I knew, we went to church, and we met a biologist who said to me, "Hey, the family and I are going up to a place called Mill Creek. You want to come with us?" I said, "Oh, is it like this?" And he goes, "Oh, no." So we drove up into the Blue Mountains, and that's when I discovered there were birds and butterflies and wild plants, and this was going to be all right to live here. And so that's how I always set my deal of whether a place is worth living in, is what natural history is in the area. So I have grown to deeply appreciate the Blue Mountains. They are phenomenal. And I want to just tell you a little bit about the Blues if you don't know much about it. There's a lot more to the Blue Mountains than ATVing down trails in it. There's a lot more to the Blues than fishing the lakes. There's a lot more to the Blue Mountains than driving through them. You miss most everything when you're in a motor vehicle in the Blue Mountains. They are phenomenal. They're 100 miles across and 416 miles long. So they stretch from Pomeroy, Washington to Prineville, Oregon. And they include separate ranges. So you have the Ochoco Mountains, the Aldrich Mountains, the Wallowa Mountains, the Elkhorn Mountains. Those are all subdivisions of the Blue Mountains. So the Blues are massive. And the numbers of animals and birds and insects and native plants is mind-boggling. So I want to share with you just a few of the plants that are up here. So there are 8 species of orchids that grow in the Blue Mountains, and most of them come up in the spring of the year. But right now there's an orchid that's blooming at Target Meadows, and it's called a lady tress. It is absolutely beautiful. It stands about that high, and most of the vegetation at Target Meadows is now 3 feet high. So lady tresses bloom down below the line of all of the rest of the vegetation. So most people go crashing out through Target Meadows, never see them. But they're gorgeous. There is another one, and it is called Minner's Orchid, coral red. And it is an orchid, and it is gorgeous. And it only comes up after the soils have dried out and the heat comes on. And so that's counterintuitive to most people that think about orchids, that they would normally just come up when it's moist and cool and they have lots of water. Well, there are plants that have figured out strategies to live, and they have been designed to be that way. So we live in a world, a natural world, that was designed to fit. And so we as humans have introduced all kinds of organisms that don't fit in the natural native design that was placed in this area. So we've introduced invasive weeds and birds and insects, all kinds of stuff, because we see it as valuable to us. And we disregard the effect on the natural world. So I will tell you, you go up into the Blue Mountains, and I would like to just name a few spots I would urge you to go and visit. They are outstanding. One of them is a place called Jarbow Meadows, and it was named after a sheep farmer who used to graze his flocks of sheep up there. Jarbow is off the 6200 road as you head out east towards Troy, Oregon. Jarbow is absolutely gorgeous. I have been there dozens of times and never once met another soul. It's huge and nobody goes there. So it could afford your visit. It is absolutely beautiful. It has a shallow lake in one end, and it is all native grass and vegetation everywhere else. It's absolutely spectacular. If you set up chairs, see this butterfly right here behind us? That's a great spangled fritillary, and they only live above 1,800 feet. So you know you're above 1,800 feet. So Jawbone Meadows is absolutely spectacular. If you set up chairs, you can see elk walk across the meadow. I've seen black bears out in the meadow. I saw a bobcat out in the meadow. It's just a great spot to sit and observe. So one of the things the Blue Mountains bring with them is quiet. And I'll tell you, you can always tell when a human has entered the forest because they're gunning their engines, they're loud, and it's like, people, quiet down and just enjoy the woods. But that's not why some people go to the forest. They go to rip and tear and scare, and it scares everything. And they miss the opportunity of seeing all kinds of wildlife. The amazing thing about the Blue Mountains, I have two more spots I'm going to talk to you about. The amazing thing is when you get up there, as you climb in elevation, you come to different plant communities. And those plant communities dictate what mammals and what birds and what insects are present in those areas. So when you're down low, say the foothills around here, you can see all the brown grass and the steep slopes. There are actually birds that enjoy that and live only in those areas. So you get up higher and the grass starts to green up because there's higher moisture, and that is brings on a whole different set of plants and animals. So two other spots I want you to consider going. One is called Big Spring. You ever heard of Big Spring? It's south of Pomeroy, Washington, in the Blue Mountains, and it's this beautiful spring that comes right out of the ground and creates a stream and flows right across the ground. And there's a campground there, and never once in 10 years of working for the Forest Service did I ever see anyone camp there. Not once! And it's like, wow! And then the other one in the Blue Mountains is a little south of us. Yes?
If I were to put Big Spring into my search in Google, would it come up?
If you put Big Spring, Garfield County, it would come up.
Okay.
Yeah. So the other one is south of us, and it's called Divide Well Campground. And Divide Well is out of Ukiah, Oregon, on the road towards Heppner. And there is a whole area in the Blue Mountains there called Potamus Lookout, Potamus Point. And this is an area that is a high plateau. It's 3,200 feet above the John Day River. And you can look way down into the John Day from up there. And Divide Well is this wonderful campground. Only once in 10 years did I ever come across anyone camping at Divide Well. Only once. It is an amazing place. And nobody there. So I just want you to get out, explore the Blue Mountains, but do it with good conservation and stewardship in mind. And I'll tell you, there are lots of people that are great conservationists, and it only takes a few to mess it up. And so I got to the point where if I saw someone doing something, I would walk over and educate them on the error of their way, in a nice way. So it is well worth it. But Divide Well, Big Spring, and Jawbone Meadow, I would urge you, take a visit. Absolutely gorgeous places. So, in closing, I just want you to think about the world that we live in. We have been provided this world, and we are the stewards of this natural history that we live in. And we like to think that it doesn't affect us, we can do anything we want, but it's not so. The natural world is, in many places, suffering because of humans. And Christians are, we are charged with taking care of God's second book. And we are in charge of its maintenance and its stewardship. And we each are responsible for that. And when I think of what our human race does to the planet today, I get petrified because many, many people are not doing, and they are not following God's conditions. And so lots of people, I get lots of questions about pantheism. I get lots of questions about worshiping the creation and not the creator. The bottom line is, it is God's second book, and we are charged with its stewardship. And that's been very, very clear. And in Kings, it actually says, I will destroy those that destroy the earth. And it's very clear. And it's very short, very succinct verse. And I think it's pretty clear. And so think about what you're doing out there. But think about your water use. Think about what you do to the air. These are all important things. So I want to thank you for the privilege, and I want to thank Dennis for his very kind introduction.
And Mike, do you have a few minutes to talk about you and Daniel?
Sure, you bet. So I was talking with Roger and also talking with Daniel Biggs. I met Daniel, and he is a gentleman that moved here from La Grande, Oregon. And he started in as a realtor.
Yeah.
And Dan Biggs then became a Christian and joined the church. And now he works at Blue Mountain Television. But the amazing gift the man has is photography and editing what he creates. And so Dan and I have been out 7 times, and we are in the process of creating a 13-part series on the wildlife and plants of the Blue Mountains. And it will be on Blue Mountain Television and probably early part of next year. But we go out once a week and go and photograph for 4.5 to 5 hours every week. Dan is a superb photographer, and he's one of the nicest, gentlest people you will ever meet. And he has a gift, an incredible gift. So I want to share with you one quick story about what happened to Dan and I. I was contacted by a good friend of mine, and he said, hey, I have property over by Somerville, Oregon. And he says, I have a pair of great gray owls nesting on my property. And he said, you're welcome to come and photograph them. So we went over, and lo and behold, the female great gray, which is an owl that's 27 inches tall, and everyone used to think they were the biggest, largest, most powerful owl on earth, it's all fluff. They weigh 1.75 pounds. That's it. And they feed on small rodents. And they sit on small trees, so you see this huge bird sitting on a small little pine. And it's like, how does he do that? Well, great horned owls and barred owls weigh 3 pounds. And they could take out a great gray with ease. But they don't, because they assume that huge mass of feathers has a big, bulky body under it. It doesn't. So great gray owls are phenomenal. They're beautiful. They're circumpolar in distribution. They're found all across the taiga of Asia and Europe and all across North America. So we went over, and Dan got some of the spectacular images, and you will see it on this series. Incredible images. And then he edited a short video of it, and it's amazing. It's absolutely beautiful. So anyway, look for that. It's coming. And we still have 2.5, 3 months to still shoot. So we're out every week. So anyway, thank you for your attention. And take care of what you see out there. We're responsible for it. Thank you.
Yeah.